Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 13, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And two interviews lined up for tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll speak with Elizabeth Economy, who is a China expert at the Hyper-Establishment Council on Foreign Relations. She specializes not only in China's economy, but the environmental aspects of Chinese economic development, and that is not a pretty story. So we will talk to her about that. Another downside of the tremendous boom that's gone on in China for the last two decades. And then at the bottom of the hour, interview recorded earlier this week with Douglas Massey, who is a sociologist who's been head of a team that's been studying Mexican migration into the United States for more than 20 years. And so we'll talk to him about what's going on with the Mexicans who are coming into the United States. One thing he is interesting point he makes is that the hypermilitarization of the border that's been going on in recent years actually encourages people to stay. And there used to be a much more casual back-and-forth movement when the border wasn't so tightly policed. But now the tightness of the control at the border is encouraging people, once they get through, to stick around. Look at the economic headlines before we get to Elizabeth's economy. First of all, last Friday, the Labor Department, Bureau of Labor Statistics, released its monthly employment report. The job market showing solid gains in March. This consists generally of two surveys, one of employers and one of households. The one survey of employers asks questions about number of jobs, wages, and hours, and the one of households is the source of the more familiar unemployment numbers. On the employers survey, though, reporting that employers added 211,000 jobs in the month of March, which is a good number. It's not a terrific number. If we were expanding at the rate we saw in the 1990s, we'd probably be seeing closer to 300,000. But by the standards of the last few years, 211,000 is quite a solid number. Curiously, though, nearly one of in six of the new jobs generated in March came from bars and restaurants. And this sector has been strong for quite some time. It's responsible for one in nine new jobs over the last year. The industry employs just 1 in 15 workers, so it's really overrepresented in new job growth. I don't know what this means exactly, but maybe people are drinking away their sorrows. The unemployment rate fell a tenth of a point to 4.7% and actually came very, very, very close to rounding down to 4.6%. This is the lowest unemployment rate we've seen since the summer of 2001, although it's still well above the April 2000 trough of 3.8%. Now, the unemployment rate is generously defined from the point of view of employers, rather meanly defined from the point of view of people looking for work. If you're employed even for an hour, you're counted as having a job. You have to be out looking for work actively in order to be counted as unemployed. Otherwise, you're counted as not in the labor force. But the movements up and down do measure trends accurately, and this is the best number we've seen in some time. This morning, the Labor Department reporting an uptick in the number of people seeking unemployment insurance for the first time, people who've lost their jobs heading over to the Unemployment Insurance Office for benefits. That's up 12,000 on the week, it's been ticking up a little bit since its lows in early January. It does show at least some signs of a slowdown in the job market, but that's not yet been visible in the monthly employment numbers. We shall see if this appears in the coming months. This morning also reported that retail sales up 0.6% in the month of March, a pretty good number. Year-over-year growth, 8%. And if you strip out automobiles, over 9%. Americans are spending money like crazy, even though the job market's not so great and wages aren't growing. They are just spending money with both hands and maybe even using one or two of their feet as well. This resulting in, of course, huge trade deficits, chronic trade deficits, because we buy so much more than we make here. But the Commerce Department reporting earlier in the week that our trade deficit was down, surprisingly, in the month of February. But this does seem to be related to the Chinese New Year, the timing of Chinese New Year. Whenever Chinese New Year occurs, it shows up in the trade statistics. Apparently, people take off rather than exporting to Walmart. So this is probably a one-month anomaly. And let's see. I think since time is short, I will just say a couple of things about the two leading indicators that have come out recently. The weekly leading indicator by the Economic Cycles Research Institute for the U.S. economy, ticking up after ending a long slide down that began in January. So that portending a slowdown later in the year, followed by perhaps a recovery. So U.S. economy doing okay, not terrifically, but okay, and little sign of that changing anytime soon. The OECD, the Paris-based think tank for the rich industrial countries, it has a monthly leading index for its economies that's designed to forecast where they're heading. Almost all of them are up, and it's been quite an uptrend in that. So it does seem like the world's economies are expanding. And interestingly, Japan is expanding, as is the EU, two areas of the world that have not been doing very well economically in quite some time, are showing some signs of recovery and even expansion. Let's take a little musical break while we get Elizabeth Economy on the line.
China, my China, I wandered around and you're still here, which I guess you should be proud of. Your walls have been closed, have kept you at home for thousands of years. But there's something I should tell you. All the young boys, they are dressing like sailors.
And that a cheesy setup for this interview segment, a little bit of Brian Eno's song, China, My China, from Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. Boy, it must be 30 years ago. And now we're joined on the line by Elizabeth Economy, who is a China specialist with the Council on Foreign Relations based here in New York. Welcome to WBAI.
Thanks very much.
Just a comment first. I see in today's Financial Times there's an editorial or some sort of commentary remarking on the fact that while the president of China, Hu Jintao, is coming to Washington next week to meet with President Bush. The premier, Wen Jiabao, is on a tour of Asia, and the FT concluding that Chinese diplomacy in Asia may really actually be much more important than what's going on with the U.S.-China relationship. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that the United States, the relationship with the United States continues to be the most important one for China, but it's certainly true that Asia has risen very rapidly, and on China's agenda, South Korea and Japan now have China as their number one trading partner. There are a number of regional strategic issues that are important for China, North Korean Peninsula, relations with Japan, obviously the Taiwan issue. But I think still, United States provides enormous export market for China. Obviously, they hold our treasury bills. We have enormous economic interdependence, and China still recognizes the United States as the sole remaining superpower, if we can still be called such.
And, of course, the economic relationship in which, as Laura Tyson once put it, Asia lends, America spends, that's
yes.
China is very much central to that, and no signs of that changing anytime soon, right?
No.
You've written quite a bit on the darker sides of the Chinese economic miracle, and particularly a book, The Rivers Run Black, about the ecological catastrophe of Chinese economic development. How bad are things in the Chinese environment?
Well, as befits the title of my book, The River Runs Black, I have a pretty pessimistic view of the current state of affairs. I think it's, look, China has 5 of the world's 10 most polluted cities, right, in terms of air quality. As they were running the Beijing Marathon the other day, the city government was telling everybody to stay indoors because the air pollution was so bad that they were expecting an enormous spike in respiratory infections and visits to the hospital.
Not so good for runners to be
breathing.
No,
not so good for runners, and obviously of significant concern as we're looking toward 2008 and the Olympics. In terms of water quality, 40% of the water that goes through China's rivers is unfit for even agriculture or industry. You know, the Chinese government announced this year that 190 million Chinese drink water that's so polluted it's making them sick. I can go on and on with statistics that sort of paint a pretty devastating picture. And this has been going on for, centuries to some extent, but certainly very dramatic environmental degradation and pollution over the past few decades with China's extraordinary economic growth.
Yeah, if you're clocking growth rates of 10% or so for 20 years straight,
right,
you're bound to have some ecological consequences. Is China particularly bad? I mean, given that kind of rate of growth, are things worse than they should be, or is it pretty much in line with the kinds of the growth rates we've seen?
No, I think that they're worse than they should be in a couple of respects. I mean, first of all, given China's growing wealth, it spends very little in terms of sort of its social welfare goods, the environment included. So it spends about 1.3% of its GDP on environmental protection. That places it somewhere in the middle of developing countries. Even Chinese scientists say it should be around 2.2% to keep the situation just from deteriorating. They have access to technology. I mean, when, the U.K. or the U.S., people like to make the comparison, when U.K. and U.S. developed, we went through the same stage and stuff. But the truth is there's access to technology now, and they can afford it. And they elect, not really to put in the sort of incentives and disincentives to make businesses and officials use this technology. So you don't price water high enough. It's at about 20% of replacement cost. Or the fines that you have to pay for letting your company pollute are so low that factories would rather pay the fines than do anything about the pollution. So there are a lot of political and economic and technological fixes that China could make, but they just aren't.
Well, you say they can afford it, but it's kind of hard to classify China. And in some ways, it looks, at least in some regions, almost like an advanced, rich, sophisticated country. And on the other side, it's still dominated by a rather poor peasantry. So how rich is China really? How much of this boom we've seen is just in the economic statistics, and how much is really on the ground in the lives of Chinese people?
Well, I mean, that's a terrific question. And you're certainly right. The income disparities have grown to the point now that China is a far more unequal society than the United States is, which is pretty astonishing for a country that, two and a half decades ago or three decades ago was, still in the midst of the great communist experiment. But they have, $853 billion in foreign exchange reserves. They can certainly afford to spend more than 3.5% of their GDP on, health and education and welfare. You're looking at a country now that has only about 10% of its population covered by any form of a pension system. I think the challenge really is that, China has moved the market to the fore, but has forgotten to put in place any sort of social welfare net to replace what they had, two or three decades ago. So I think that there's a lot of sort of makeup work to do, whether you're looking at education or healthcare or the pension system.
Well, how's the attitude of the leadership been, let's just grow fast for a while and then we'll take care of this stuff later, or have they just not even thought about it?
Well, up until the current leadership of Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao, I think that was the attitude. The attitude was just grow, grow, grow. It was sort of, you know, Deng Xiaoping actually talked about trickle-down economics as sort of the Chinese strategy.
Some commie here.
Exactly. You know, make the coastal provinces wealthy first, and then the money will, you know, move into the center and to the western regions. It hasn't actually happened like that. There hasn't been a lot of wealth transfer.
Yeah, the regional disparities have only widened since then, haven't they?
That's right. Yeah. And to the point that, you know, there's now the poorest part of China is about, the average income is about 1/12 that in the wealthiest parts of China. So,
and to put it in perspective, there's just nothing like that in the United States. It's you know, a fraction of that. The ratio is just a fraction of that, right?
That's right. I mean, again, China is more unequal than the United States, which I continue to find astonishing, even though I study this country, you know, for 15 years. So I think that, you know, there's progress to be made. The Chinese government recognizes, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao recognize, for the first time we have a leadership in China that has said, actually, there are some really significant downsides to this, the way that our economy has grown, the corruption, the failure to provide this kind of social welfare net. They have a whole sort of language that has developed around this idea of a harmonious society that they want to, you know, put into place that means redressing these kinds of problems. But I would have to say that in the past 3 years, they have made really no progress on this, on addressing this issue. And in fact, I think have, you know, opened a very wide debate within China about the future of the country.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, they do seem to be having quite a, at least visible to a general reader like me, quite an open debate on these sorts of issues. Is this kind of debate new in China?
I think that the debate has always been there, sort of simmering beneath the surface. I think that, but what Premier Wen and President Hu have done is to say that, well, we got it pretty much right for the past 20 years, but, you know, there were some problems. They've sort of opened Pandora's box, and they've allowed people beneath the Politburo. I think there's a lot of division. I think maybe there's consensus, you know, within the very, very top, you know, 16 to 20 Chinese leaders, but I think underneath that, among the thinkers and the, you know, senior officials, there's a large disagreement about the sort of pace and scope that economic reform should move in China. To what extent should China continue to be open, so greatly open to foreign investment, on the one hand, and then I think the great political debate right now going on about the future of political reform. You know, you have the party school, which trains Chinese officials. You know, in a poll of the party school, they said 60% of the people said that they thought political reform was the most pressing need for China. So there's clearly a lot of thinking going on and a lot of debate going on in this country.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Economy, who is a China expert at the Council on Foreign Relations here in New York. Well, how control? We tend to think of the Chinese state as being very strong and in control of everything that goes on in the country. But are they, or has this kind of rapid economic development generated an economic power that's completely apart from state power?
I think that's a good way of putting it, and I think in many different respects the Chinese state does not exercise the kind of control that it would like. And we can see it in terms of the enforcement of Chinese laws, and whether you're looking at environmental laws or laws on education, laws on taxes, laws on intellectual property rights, whatever it is, we see that Beijing is not able to reach very far down into the local areas. There's a huge decentralization of authority that has taken place within the system that Beijing encouraged, because they encouraged the provinces to get rich, right, and to get rich quick. That was the primary motivation. They devolved both political and economic authority, and now they're finding it very difficult to reclaim that power. So I think this is another big challenge for the central state.
Yeah, I would think if I was at the top of that heap, I'd be very reluctant to talk about political reform then. So they must be a little reluctant to go too far down that road.
Well, I think there's hesitation because, you know, by and large, what is the goal of the current leadership in China? Well, it's to maintain their power, right, to maintain their own standing. But I do think that as they look, what they need to do is to rout out corruption. You know, corruption is endemic in this society. And so when they're trying to think of how are you going to hold local officials accountable, you know, what are the mechanisms available to them? Well, sure, they talk about strengthening the rule of law. That is a very, very slow process in China. One of the quickest ways to do it, of course, would be to begin to hold elections, to begin to allow the people to have a greater voice in who's governing them. And they have allowed non-governmental organizations to develop, and the sort of a flourishing civil society has emerged. So there are ways in which the Chinese government understands that they cannot simply, you know, pluck out every single corrupt Chinese official or anyone who's simply not paying attention to the directives from Beijing. They need bottom-up, watchdog kind of ability, and the people are their strongest asset. But you're quite right. They're still not quite ready to trust them that much.
I remember reading a quote from, I think it was from People's Daily back in the 80s, that said, corruption is a sign of social progress. So,
I think I missed that brilliant one.
They're making lots of social progress. Where was I going with this? I know where I'm going now. From time to time in the business press, you read reports of a lot of labor unrest, strikes, protests, also a lot of stories about rural protests by very disaffected peasantry. And further in the business press, you also read from time to time that Chinese wages are rising and it's going to price itself out of the cheap labor market sometime soon. What do you make of those reports?
Let's talk about, there's pretty sort of two different issues, and I think let's talk about the protests one first. I think, if we look just over the past 3 years, the number of protests that the Chinese government has recorded has increased from 57,000 in 2003 to 70.
They keep statistics on this?
They do indeed. They do indeed. And it's always an interesting question as to why they actually report them.
Yeah.
To 74,000 in 2004, to 87,000 protests last year in China. And these run the gamut from, protests over environmental pollution. People understand these factories aren't making them sick and they can't get any sort of redress from local officials. To failure to be compensated for their land. This is another big issue, sort of land grabs by corrupt officials, and also striking workers. And they're not striking so much because they've lost their jobs, but because the pension and medical care benefits that they'd been promised for 3 or 4 decades have simply disappeared. They've evaporated, and in many cases, the company heads, the factory heads, have simply absconded with the funds. So there's this kind of situation percolating, on the ground. And this is significant social unrest that the Chinese government has to negotiate. So I think that is a big challenge and not one with an end in sight. As far as the issue of sort of the pressure from higher wages, I think there's going to be a very interesting transition coming in China because they're also talking about higher prices for commodities now. And in general, I think we're going to see that the cost of doing business in China is going to increase. And then the question becomes, are some of these, multinationals that have been, to a large extent, the engine of much of the growth in the coastal regions, are they going to start looking elsewhere, to Vietnam, to Turkey, to Poland, where some of them are already looking in these places? So I think it's going to be interesting to see how China manages this kind of transition period.
Well, they do have at least a considerable number of skilled workers who are just more than your 10-cent an hour labor, aren't they?
I'm sorry, more than your...
More productive than just 10-cent an hour low-wage labor. Can they make the transition to move up the value chain, as they say?
Well, they don't have enough.
They don't have enough.
I mean, it's one of the great challenges for multinationals they talk about all the time. Is just the number of skilled, and we're talking, sort of at the top level, most highly educated Chinese, there just aren't enough to fill the jobs. And so there's a lot of competition for the best Chinese in the banking sectors or Chinese who can do, advertising or whatever it might be in the services sector, for example. There's a lot of competition for the top Chinese. They don't have enough people. So there's a... and when you hear these huge numbers of engineers being graduated, for example, right, 300 and some thousand engineers a year, well, I don't know whether you saw, McKinsey did a study that said that actually only about 10% of them can function or are the equal of sort of international standards of engineering that we have in the West. So I think that sometimes you have to look very carefully at the nuances of all of this in some ways to understand the reality of the situation, because if you just look at the numbers, I think you can get the wrong impression.
Well, it seems like the Chinese have a considerable number of challenges on their hands right now. One is trying to make a transition from just being a low-wage export platform to something more sophisticated, shifting more towards internal demand away from export demand, but also the kinds of ecological and social and political challenges you've been talking about for the last 15 minutes. Can they make it?
Well, that's a big question. And I mean, I think they can, but I think that they're reaching the end of a period of time. And my sense is that they are going to have some pretty fundamental reform. And whether they are, you know, willing to undertake that, whether they are willing to be bold enough to do that, I think remains to be seen. Because what we've seen thus far is really just, you know, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao using the sort of tried and true methods, you know, anti-corruption campaigns, you know, making officials come in for 2 days a week of re-education campaigns. They've started up with sort of studying Marxism-Leninism again, you know, putting in millions of dollars to print up new, you know, books on this and educate officials again and college students. This is not the kind of reform that the country needs. So we'll have to see.
Well, how much are they influenced by or frightened by the experience of the Soviet Union's collapse?
Oh, I mean, that remains sort of the big dark cloud out there for them. On a number of fronts, they want to avoid what happened to the Soviet Union. And look, you know, apparently President Putin told, it was either President Hu or Premier Wen Jiabao that, you know, you have to beware of NGOs and civil society because they can be a cover for, you know, political activism and democracy reform. So, you know, it's not only they look at the collapse of the Soviet Union, they have the current leader of Russia telling them, you know, don't follow our experience.
Well, George Soros has gotten out of that game at least. Okay, so we've got the president of China coming over to Washington next week to chat with our president. What do you think they'll be talking about?
I think, you know, that the key issues are going to be the sort of overall economic relationship, trade and currency, and then North Korea and Iran. And I think sort of at a second tier down will be the whole idea advanced by Deputy Secretary of State Bob Zelek about China as a responsible stakeholder in the international system and how do we get China to play by international norms on a whole range of issues, and energy or the environment or public health or whatever it might be. But I think really the top is the sort of trade and currency and security issues.
Well, the U.S. position on trade is a little strange. We seem to be blaming the Chinese because we want to import so much from them. Is it really their fault?
Yeah, there is that aspect to it. You know, I think it's certainly the Chinese can do better in a couple of areas, and intellectual property rights being one. Now, you know, estimates of what kind of difference it would make if China would protect the intellectual property rights of U.S. multinationals are range from, you know, $20 billion to $60 billion, and maybe it's somewhere in between. That does not make up for the $200 billion trade deficit that, you know, we're going to be facing with them. And then there's the issue of currency reform, and I mean, there's a point to be made there. You know, China needs to make some progress on that for their own good as well as for the good of the U.S., but, you know, from everything that is being said, it's not just a problem with the Chinese. It's a problem that sort of moves throughout Asia in terms of currency manipulation. And just for the Chinese to do something is not going to make that big a difference. But there's room for improvement, absolutely. Is it going to address fundamentally sort of the challenge that we have in our bilateral trade deficit? No.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Economy. Elizabeth Economy is a China expert at the Council on Foreign Relations based here in New York City. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back to turn to the subject of immigration.
Hello, we are Kinky. You're listening to WBAI. Estás escuchando WBAI. Y quédate con nosotros. Keep with us.
New York City.
Hola, nosotros somos Kinky de México. You're listening to WBAI. Keep with us.
New York City.
Atlas. Vamos con Pinky.
Hace ya mes María José se fue a tomar a la cantina un solo trago que se convierte en botella una voz.
And this is WBAI, as they said. in New York City, 99.5 on the FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. Streaming better than ever, I understand. I actually haven't tried it myself, but the streams are greatly enhanced. So visit WBAI.org and listen to us anywhere in the world. And we'll be listening in a minute or two to an interview I recorded with Douglas Massey, who is a sociologist who's been studying Mexican immigration to the United States for better than 20 years. But just wanted to point to a couple of articles in the newspapers today. First, a piece in the Wall Street Journal on the immigration debate reaching the heartland. And I suggested this last week, that some of the places that are most opposed to immigrants are those in which there aren't a lot of them around. And it does seem like a lot of the political energy coming out of the right wing of the Republican Party for punitive anti-immigrant legislation is coming from people in the heartland who just don't like the fact that a few Mexicans have moved in. So it really is xenophobia of a rather stinky sort. But it does seem to be energizing some Republican House candidates who are facing tough re-election fights come this fall. So I think they want to whip up the Yahoo vote by bashing immigrants a very unattractive feature of American politics. But also a piece in today's San Francisco Chronicle with the headline, "Polls Leaders Say Many Blacks Support Illegal Immigrants," degree of support for immigration. According to a field poll in California that was released earlier this week, showing 82% of African Americans offering support for undocumented workers being given the opportunity to become citizens. 76% of Latinos take that position, and 74% of whites. So very much significantly stronger support among the black respondents to this poll than white respondents, at least in California. The perception of a common racism and anti-immigrant feeling is probably has something to do with that. Let's turn now to an interview I recorded earlier in the week with Douglas Massey, who is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, and who has been doing research on international migration, race and housing, discrimination, education, urban poverty, and Latin America, especially Mexico. He's been directing a project that's been studying Mexican immigration to the United States for better than 20 years. And he had a piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago pointing out the fact that hyper-militarizing the border actually encourages people to stay here rather than move back and forth in a fluid fashion. So I thought it'd be worth giving him a call and doing a broad-ranging interview on the topic of Mexican immigration into the United States. So Douglas Massey. You write that the perception that there's been a rise in the number of Mexican immigrants coming across the border, that perception is highly misplaced. Could you tell us something about the flow of immigrants northwards?
Well, according to the data that we've been collecting for the past 20 years, the rate of migration into the United States has been more or less flat and stable. If anything, it's declined in the last 5 or 10 years a little bit. What's really changed is the rate of migration back from the United States to Mexico. And that really is a direct consequence of our border enforcement policy. The ironic consequence of increasing the deterrent presence, the enforcement presence at the border, increasing the number of Border Patrol officers, and really militarizing the border in a very significant way, is you don't deter people from coming so much as you really discourage them from going home once they're here. They minimize border crossing by hunkering down and staying once they've already made it across. And so we've actually had a substantial increase in the number of undocumented migrants living in the U.S., even though the rate of entry has been fairly flat.
Could you give us a history of how porous or tightly controlled the border has been over the last 20 years?
Well, the border has always been fairly porous. From the period from, say, 1985, from 1965 to 1985, it was a highly circular flow with large flows inward and large flows outward, heavily composed of working-age males doing seasonal or short-term work in the United States. And there was relatively little settlement. In 1986, with the Immigration Reform and Control Act, we began a process of border buildup, of increasing enforcement resources. And from 86 onward, you start to see a decline in the rate of return migration. And then the rate of return migration plummets after 1993, 1994, when the Border Patrol launched its various operations, Operation Blockade and Operation Gatekeeper in El Paso and in San Diego. And after those dates, you really find a large increase in the length of trips and a substantial decline in the rate of return migration, which gives us the population growth we've witnessed.
Is this kind of a back-and-forth flow typical of immigrants to the United States, or is Mexico unusual in that way?
There's a lot more out-migration among immigrants than people like to think. On average, across all the groups that come into the country, after about 10 years, a third of immigrants have gone home. So that's kind of the overall rate of return migration. Mexicans historically have been much higher because they're a bordering country, and Mexicans, when they migrate, their goal is not so much to settle in the U.S. permanently, but to earn some money to solve a problem at home and then return home with the earnings to solve that problem, buying some land, financing the construction of a house, paying for schooling, whatever. But left to their own devices, most migrants would probably come to the United States once or twice in the course of their working lives, work for 2 to 3 years per stint, and then return home.
People may intend to make a visit temporary. How often is that actually the case? Do people tend to stay longer than initially anticipated or not?
Well, there's always a settlement process with any migration flows. So even though people begin as target earners seeking to earn a set amount of money and go home, the longer people stay north of the border, the more contacts they acquire here, the more connections they make, and the more likely they are to settle. What happens when you militarize the border is you start extending the trip lengths, and those contacts start to form, and then return migration becomes progressively less likely over time.
It seems that the U.S. has a very divided attitude towards controlling the flow of people across the border. Because, on the one hand, the economy depends upon the labor very much. On the other hand, there's a lot of nationalist fervor about keeping out the foreigners. Do you see this contradiction operating in border control policy?
Oh, there's a huge contradiction that lies at the heart of our policy in North America. On the one hand, we have entered into a treaty with Mexico and Canada, and the treaty envisions lowering the border, the barriers to cross-border movement of goods, of capital, of information, of services, and some kinds of people. But then magically, as we're integrating the North American economy, increasing flows across the border of all sorts, we want to somehow prevent the movement of labor. And it's just a fundamental contradiction that we've tried to finesse by throwing enforcement resources at the border, but in the end it just backfired and ended up producing a larger population of undocumenteds in the U.S. than otherwise would have been the case.
I realize this isn't your specialty, but do you have any sense of why this this issue has come to the boil over the last several months? It was always there, but much more under the surface than it seems in the last weeks and months.
Well, I think the numbers have built up. We're talking about a population of around 11 million people. That's a record number. And these people see themselves as working and contributing to American society. Many of them would only want to work here temporarily if they could, and yet they're being demonized as somehow criminal and somehow threatening. And I think they and their family members and many of their friends who are citizens finally just had enough and decided to make a stand and make a forceful statement that they're not criminals, they're workers, that they want to be law-abiding citizens, and if given the chance, they will be more than willing to do so.
What do we know about the demographics of migrants from Mexico? What kind of age, sex, region? What's their demographic profile?
Well, immigration from Mexico, of course, has a very long history going back to the turn of the 20th century. So Mexicans coming into the U.S. is hardly anything new. As far back as we can go, we know that about at least half of all migrants from Mexico come from a small set of states in west central Mexico, not from the border region, but from states that are kind of clustered around the city of Guadalajara. And these states are Jalisco, Michoacán, San Luis Potosí, Zacatecas, and Guanajuato. Those five states really incorporate about half of all migrants at any point in time. The typical migrant is of working age. In the past, it was heavily male. Lately, it's become more family-oriented, but still very much within the working ages. They have about average education for Mexicans of those ages, and they're very high rates of labor force participation in the United States and very low rates of service usage in the United States, and according to our data, have very high rates of tax payment that far exceed their use of services.
Yeah, what about that? I mean, there's this perception that immigrants, particularly Mexicans, are a drain on our national resources, but how does that balance out?
I certainly don't see it in the data that we've been collecting, and we've probably got the best data around on the subject. We found that tax payment rates are actually going up over time and increased from the 80s into the 1990s and up to the early part of the 2000s. At the same time, especially in the late 1990s, rates of service usage went way down, so the balance has actually been getting more and more favorable. There's been kind of a chilling effect with migrants staying away from using social services, even ones to which they're entitled, like schools and medical services, and certainly very, very low rates of participation in social transfer programs, at the same time that their rate of tax payment is going up.
Yeah, I'm guessing these are people who contribute to the Social Security system but are not all that likely to draw on it someday.
Well, they're very unlikely to draw on it under current circumstances. And even if many of these people were to regularize tomorrow, they would be unable to make claims because many of them are paying into the same Social Security numbers. There'd be no way to really trace back their contributions. So in some sense, the Social Security system particularly has been getting a significant subsidy from immigrant workers.
You describe some studies. What kind of studies have you been doing? Are you studying people at the border? Are you studying people as they settle in the United States? What's the scope of your work?
Well, I've been co-directing a research project called the Mexican Migration Project since 1982. And every year we go into communities around Mexico, do representative samples of those communities, find out who in those communities has been to the United States, collected information about their first and last trips to the U.S., and give every household head a complete history of migration and border crossing. When we do those surveys in Mexico, we find out very quickly where people go in the U.S. So a couple months later, we go to the U.S. side and go to the destination communities where people from those communities in Mexico have in fact settled, and do parallel surveys of settled out migrants. So we actually collect data on both sides of the border to get a binational perspective on the origin communities, the settlement communities, and the streams of people moving back and forth.
And how have those settlement communities changed over time? I know when I was first living in New York in the early 1980s, there were very few Mexicans here. Now there seem like quite a few. Are there other changes in the patterns of settlement?
Yeah, the big story of the 1990s was a big shift in the geographic destinations of particularly Mexicans, but to a lesser extent all immigrants. Mexicans were heavily concentrated before the 1990s in three basic states, in California, of course, Texas, and Illinois were the three big states for Mexican settlement. During the 1990s, this all changed, and there was, in particular, a very forceful movement away from California. And where did they go? They went to almost everywhere in the United States. Now, virtually all 50 states are receiving significant numbers of Mexican immigrants, and places that had not only never received Mexicans before, they'd never received any immigrants before. So there are large Mexican immigrant populations growing in Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Iowa, Nebraska. Even Alaska has its Mexican population. So it's really become, instead of a regional phenomenon affecting three states, it is now a national phenomenon affecting all 50 states.
And how have these new target regions reacted to their new residents?
there's been a variety of different reactions in some places where there really was no history of immigration. The initial reactions were kind of a puzzlement and even confusion about what was happening. There are some tensions between the new immigrants and Native American minorities, particularly in southern states, but other places that were used to receiving immigrants before, just not Mexicans, have taken it all in stride. So they didn't make a big splash in New York City, for example, even though the migration from Mexicans is relatively new. It's an immigrant city for hundreds of years. There's more of a shock, I think, in smaller communities in Iowa or in Nebraska or in some of the southern states where, especially in semi-rural areas or non-metropolitan areas, they can have a big impact on local populations in a very short period of time. But on the whole, the reactions have been fairly muted, and while there are tensions and problems, there haven't been any systematic or serious outbreaks of violence or intergroup conflict.
Well, there's this Farmingville, Long Island, I guess, is a prominent exception. Well, the two cliches about Mexican immigrants to the United States in particular are that they're either stealing our jobs or they're doing jobs that Americans don't want to do. How do you fall down between those cliches?
Well, yeah, Mexicans get accused of everything. They're stealing jobs, taking jobs Americans don't want to do, and simultaneously going on welfare, which seems pretty much of a inherent self-contradiction. They're not going on welfare. They're not really using public services. In terms of jobs, I think that the econometric evidence is not very good because the data are very difficult to get a hold of. Most of the economists, I think the consensus view is that to the extent that there are effects on Native American workers, they tend to be relatively small. They tend to be positive for people in higher skilled categories and slightly negative for some of the people in lower skill categories. But on the whole, they're not very big to begin with.
How much of the recent flow of Mexican migrants is the result of displacements coming from NAFTA, either agricultural or industrial, opening up to U.S. Imports, for example? Has it been a significant factor in promoting migration?
I think NAFTA readjustments have been significant in some regions. For example, the state of Veracruz got hit very hard when the agricultural protections were ended, and suddenly coffee growers were competing with global coffee producers, and some of the farming sectors have been hit hard when they're forced to compete with Iowa farmers. But on the whole, I don't think it's been that big of a factor, especially in a place like western Mexico, this source region, the historical source region for migration to the United States, simply because people in that part of Mexico were so well connected already to the United States and to its labor market, and were already really operating in a binational labor market, that NAFTA really didn't change that.
And then finally, what kind of immigration system do you think would be the best to adopt? We live in this world of very mobile capital. We're constantly told that borders matter less and less. Yet when it comes to poorer people trying to get in the United States, suddenly the border rises in importance. What would the best way to manage this kind of issue, in your view?
Well, I think you need to adopt a different philosophy. And rather than seeing migration as some pathological event to be suppressed by applying ever greater police powers, you should look upon it as a natural consequence of globalization and integration and try to manage it in ways that reduce the negative consequences for Americans and enhance the development possibilities for the migrant-sending countries over the short to medium term. And to do that, in the case of Mexico, I think you would need to have a guest worker program that allows migrants to circulate with visas that give them labor rights in the United States, and so that they're not exploitable, but ultimately will be expected to go home. But we've also dug ourselves into a big hole at this point with 11 million people rooted here to varying degrees, and so some kind of legalization program, I think, is also in order to clear the decks. I would divide that population into two categories. One are people who entered the country as minors, and for them, they're guilty of nothing except obeying their parents, and I favor some kind of easy, relatively automatic amnesty if they've stayed out of trouble and have gone to school and done okay in the United States. For their parents who did make a choice to enter the United States illegally, I would not criminalize the people, but set a path towards earned legalization. So give them a temporary worker visa and set up a set of criteria that will authorize them to remain over the long term if they want to, if they do things like learn English, pay taxes, become homeowners, have American kids, and so on. I think that's the only humane way to proceed. And then finally, I think that we need to increase the size of the legal quota for immigration from Mexico. We've joined with Mexico in a free trade agreement to integrate our economies. It's a $1 trillion economy. It's a population of 105 million people. It's got a per capita income of $10,000 per year, which is high by third world standards. And it's a very dynamic place, and yet it has the same migration quota as Botswana or Nepal, 20,000 visas per year. And that's just too small for two countries that are so closely intertwined, so closely integrated economically, and are proceeding to get more and more integrated economically over time, not by coincidence, but by design, by a treaty that we've ratified.
And that was the voice of Doug Massey, who is a professor of sociology at Princeton University, co-director of a project on Mexican immigration into the United States, which he's been doing for more than 20 years. And he also did some very interesting work back in the 80s on residential segregation in the United States. I remember the original article, which I read based on 1980 census data, reported that New York City was one of the most segregated cities in the country residentially. I asked him if he'd updated that work, and it turns out the Census Bureau is now following the model that he set up, really, and has been publishing data on residential segregation ever since. And New York City remains one of the most segregated cities in the United States. It's not what we think of as our self-image, and certainly not something to be proud of, but it is a remarkable fact of life in the United States that New York City, which likes to think of itself as a beacon of diversity and tolerance, at least in this one measure, residential segregation is worse than many, many, many other places. The third most segregated city in the United States, according to the Census Bureau measure. And I didn't get a chance to look at that report in great detail, but I think I will do something with that sometime in the next couple of weeks. And a few weeks ago, I mentioned that I was going to start a feature of people could email any questions they had and ask the Economist kinds of questions, and I would do my best to answer them. Let me repeat that offer. The email address is dhenwood, dhenwood, at panix, panix. .com. You can also get my email address, I think, from the WBAI website on the schedule. There's a link to my email address on the Behind the News slot. But I did get one query in response to that plea. Someone asked, what's good to read on economics? What's a good introductory text on economics? And I have mentioned in the past, someone I interviewed a few weeks ago, actually, in his more recent book, Robin Hanel, H-A-H-N-E-L, has a very good book called The ABCs of Political Economy, which reviews both orthodox economics as well as the various brands of radical critiques of orthodox economics. That is a really good single volume introduction to this mysterious field. But I also find an awful lot of most economics, texts and academic economics and such, to be a mystification, much of it a waste of time. There are exceptions. There are certainly many useful things that economists do, but that's really, I think, not the place to go to find out what's really going on in the actual real-world economy. I find that the business press, actually, surprisingly enough, is a very good source of what's going on. It has a minimum of ideology. You might think that the business press would be more biased in favor of business than it actually is. But in fact, at least when you look at publications like Business Week or the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times, their audience really wants to know what's going on. They don't want it under layers of nonsense and ideology. So I would say if you really want to get a taste for what's going on with the economy, pick up Business Week or read the Wall Street Journal. The front page of the Wall Street Journal, splendid thing. I don't know how much longer it's going to survive in its present excellent form, given the pressures on the newspaper industry to cut costs and make more money. But I've got to say, the front page of the Wall Street Journal is a daily masterpiece. Usually the two stories on either side of the front page, they what the journal people call a leader. Generally extremely high standards, great journalism. So worth checking out, and probably not something that a lot of people would be inclined to. So I would say overcome that inclination and pick up a Wall Street Journal now and then. So let's bring that to a close, and we'll go out with Morrissey doing a cover of the old New York Dolls song Human Being, strangely enough. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. I'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye.